Today is Sunday, November 29th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History Part 1 interview with Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Oh, yes, please.
Thank you. Jim, what year were you born?
I was born in 1954.
Where?
In Queens, outside of New York City. What? So a town called Bayshore, and I've actually never been there since, so okay. I don't really know too much about it.
But, what were your folks doing there?
Good question. My dad at that time had just gotten he was in the service in Korea, and they were living there because it was in proximity to my grandparents who they lived in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And so I think it was a nearby hospital. And, Tom, you're asking the first question out of the bat here is a little tough for me to answer because it's pretty hazy.
No worries.
But my dad was in the service.
Okay.
And my mother, at that time she was just a homemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd just been recently married, so for a year and a half or something like that. And
do you know how they met?
Yeah, that I can answer. They went to a state college in Plattsburgh, New York, which is up at the north end of Lake Champlain, just south of the border with Quebec. And my dad was a mathematics major there, and my mother was I don't think she studied education then, because she eventually became a teacher, but I think initially she just was getting a liberal arts homemaker education there. So
okay, all right, and so they must have met, and then your dad would have been off to the Korean conflict then.
That's correct. Yeah.
Did they stay in touch?
Oh yeah, undoubtedly. Unfortunately, I don't have any letters.
Mm-hmm.
I think my sisters might have some of those.
Okay.
But I know that when they were both alive, they they spoke a lot about when we were kids. They spoke. My dad spoke to me about communicating with my mother, writing letters.
Cool.
And back and forth. Yeah. So
oh, that's fun.
It was. I think it was. I'm not sure how long he was gone. Maybe 2 years,
wow.
Something like that,
huh.
On and off. And I know that
yeah.
when immediately after I was born, within a month or so, I think it was. We traveled to San Diego, and because my dad was in the Navy,
okay.
And in the Korean War, so I lived on a base there, and I know that he came back several times on leave, and visited.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I recall that; I just remember being told that.
Yeah.
So.
What did he do in the Navy?
He was into radar and what passed for. Computers at that point, and that's where
wow.
He got his training in electronics.
Okay,
and he parlayed that into a future career in computers.
Wow.
I'm not sure. He never talked about seeing any action there, and that's one of the reasons he joined the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That he could minimize any conflict. So. But he told me they were out on an aircraft carrier called the Boxer, and which I think had a wood deck at the time. It was kind of interesting to hear these stories.
Yeah. Huh. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I did, yeah. They came after me. I had
okay.
Two sisters. Kathy and is the older one. She was born in 55, and Lori was born in 58.
Okay.
And Kathy was also born in northern New York, because both the families, both of my parents were from New York. My mother was from the New York City area, and my father was from a place called Gloversville, which is up west of Albany on the Mohawk River. And
okay.
They were born in New York as well.
Hmm. Did after he left the service, did he go ahead, did the family go back east, or did they stay out west?
Well, we went back east pretty quickly, and I think it was shortly after my dad left the service. Sorry about that. It sounds like there was a beep on the phone. But shortly after my dad finished his service, to Plattsburgh, New York.
Okay.
Which is, I'm sorry, not Plattsburgh, Newburgh. And Newburgh is about, I think, about 75 miles north of New York City on the Hudson River. And that's where IBM, International Business Machines, had its corporate headquarters. And so he got hooked up with IBM on the basis of his electronic skills that he picked up in the Navy, right? So he was involved in working on computers at an early age, at an early time in the history of electronics.
In the late 50s, early 60s, wow.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So probably was about 57, I think, when we were there, so 57, 58. So that was, I didn't appreciate it at the time, of course, I had no idea what he was doing, right? But I do remember, you know, the houses we lived in there, and I remember one particularly interesting memory I have is getting up early in the morning, like at 4, and it being black, and my dad, you know, getting ready to go hunting for deer. And so he and his buddies would go out, you know, in the country and in central New York there and go hunting for deer. And I just remember, you know, that seems so foreign, right, to get up so early in the morning in the dark and the cold and see him get all dressed up. But
yeah, they'd probably have to drive for many hours to get to where they wanted to hunt, and then...
I don't know if they had to go that far, because it was a different time, you know. Even in the 50s, there were fairly large rural areas in some of these states. Now, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, Newburgh would have been a fairly significant community, and they would have had to drive an hour or something like that, I'm guessing, to get out. I have no idea where they went, right?
Yeah, interesting.
For all I know, they could have been just in Farmer John's back, you know, farm down the hill. I just have
so
no recollection.
Is that where you went to grade school and high school?
Oh, no. Because he was with IBM, well, they had a saying, you know, IBM means I've been moved.
Oh, wow.
And, and my dad, you know, he was a systems analyst. I think that was his term. He moved up to that level, and his job was to implement the computer system that the salesman had sold to the client.
Okay.
With all the promises that were undeliverable.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, my dad would be brought in to set up the system and then get it going to the client's satisfaction, and that would be quite stressful, as I learned later, and for him.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he finished, was successful, then they'd move him on to the next installation, right? And,
wow.
And so we moved all the time. Every 3 to 4 years, we would be in a different city. So we spent some time in Northern Virginia, in the Richmond area. That was only, I think that was about 2 years. And then we moved from Virginia to Phoenix.
Wow.
In 1960.
Okay, so you're 6 years old. You've probably been able to relate to trees and trees turning color and winters in the East and snow and ice storms. And then as a six-year-old, you're landed in the desert.
Oh, yeah, and it was quite astounding, quite honestly, and you hit it right on the head there, you know. I can remember in Virginia, there was a tree in the backyard. It was some sort of a spruce or a pine, probably a pine because it's so far south there. And it was some sort of conifer in any event. And I crawled up in this thing, and I somehow affixed some cardboard or flimsy plywood or something to some of the limbs, you know. And these, I remember very distinctly that these limbs were kind of down, hanging to start with, and so I would always be slipping off this thing. I think I would fall asleep in this thing, and then I'd roll off it and, you know, go down to the ground. And so it was only a couple of feet off the ground, but it seemed like a real, you know, Swiss Family Robinson experience, being in this tree and hanging out in there.
Wow.
And then, as you've mentioned, you know, ice storms, a lot of that in Virginia, because it's not terribly cold there, but just cold enough that you get nasty weather in the winter, not the big fluffy thick snowfalls. And then we took the train across the continent,
oh,
right,
wow,
to get to Phoenix. And I remember we arrived in Phoenix around midnight at the old train station downtown Phoenix. I assume it's still there. I don't know. But I remember we got out of the train. It was like mid-July. Ooh. We walked out of the station, and it was just this sweltering Arizona heat, you know, that we had never experienced before. It was just like literally walking into an oven. And
wow.
I was like, wow, what have we gotten ourselves into?
And
you
humid,
know?
Mid-July, yeah. Monsoon season. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it was pretty exciting. I have to recall it. You know, it was late at night when we got off the train, and so I assume we went to a hotel, whatever. But I remember my sisters and I were really excited about the experience of coming to a new state, Arizona. I mean, it had just achieved statehood, right? And Phoenix at that time was pretty small, and we kind of felt like, well, we were the first ones in my entire family on both sides, my parents' side, whoever moved out of the state of New York, right?
Wow.
And they wound up moving across the country to do that.
Yeah.
Right? So it was a big experience.
I can see some very, very sad grandparents there.
Yeah, I think they probably were, for sure. And my dad's dad died when he was 17. So, there was always just the one grandparent there, and then my mom's parents lived in on Long Island, and they did a very good job coming to visit us in Phoenix. You know, they would come out every Christmas.
Smart
and they
people.
Would fly out. Yeah, it was quite the, you know, quite the thing. And I remember, of course, this was before the jets, right? At least not commercial jet service. And I remember we went to the airport, Sky Harbor, back when it was small, and you could go to the gate to welcome your incoming friends, right?
Outside with a little metal gate you could stand next to as a plane turned around and blew you over with its prop wash.
Well, it wasn't quite like that. We stayed inside, but
okay.
You know, you could go right to the door,
hmm.
and when they came down, because there was no jetway, right? They just pushed the portable stairway up to the front door of the plane,
right.
And then people would walk down and then walk across the tarmac and into the door of the terminal,
yeah.
And you could stand right at the door, right?
Cool. Yeah.
And so you could see them and wave to them, and little kids would do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, all the time. And
yeah.
And I remember my grandparents coming to the door of the plane, and you know, you're just so excited waiting to see them, and then they were there, and they were dressed immaculately. My grandfather got a suit and tie on, you know.
Wow.
And my grandmother is in a one time I just had this remembrance of her wearing this pink tight fitting I guess I would call it a dress, but it went down like to her knees, right? And with a pink pillbox hat, right? Kind of
wow.
Jackie Kennedy,
yeah,
style.
Yeah.
It was before that, but that's kind of
the
style I had. It was a real formal experience to fly at that time. You
yeah.
know, people got dressed up, and it was very expensive. You know, I appreciate that. I learned to appreciate how expensive it was for them, and these trips were significant undertakings that they went to be with their grandkids. So you know, it was a great time for sure.
Wow, nice. And they, of course, must have loved it because it would have been cold back home, and they would come to Phoenix, and Christmas is a good idea.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, in fact, I remember they would talk about it. You know, they would talk about coming to and moving to Phoenix. You know, they said, well, once Walter, that was my grandfather, once he retires retires from Sperry Rand, and then maybe we'll come out to Phoenix, too, and get a place. And they never did that, but they certainly came every year and would stay. You know, they would stay for, you know, a couple of weeks at that time. So,
how long were you in Phoenix?
Excuse me.
How long were you in Phoenix then?
Well, that was the first time. Yeah, so we lived there from 60 to 63 for 3 years. I lived in Glendale actually, and it was like we felt like it was out in the sticks, right? It was at 36th Street and. Peoria, I can't remember what the North South Street was, But it was like all cotton fields past
wow.
our residence. And so it was a great place because, you know, you could go out and with your friends into the fields and play, and or, you know, the canals were a great place to
yep.
play. Of course, you can't get anywhere near these places now as a kid, right, because they're considered so dangerous.
Right.
But and then they used to have these fantastic play areas where if they had like a if they're doing a construction site, say for a shopping center, they would, for some reason, they would fence in big piles of tumbleweeds. And you know, I'm talking to an Arizonan, so you obviously know what a tumbleweed is. Somebody
yeah.
here in Vancouver would have no idea what that is. But there were these huge piles of tumbleweeds with these like 10-foot-high fences surrounding them. I have no idea why they did this. But we actually found these things to be really very inviting play areas because you could sometimes we would actually clip the fence, and but other times you could find places where you could just naturally get through it, and
mm-hmm.
then we would tunnel in through all these tumbleweeds.
Wow.
And
it's
you know,
of,
it was
kind of
like,
prickly, you know.
Yeah, I know they were prickly, but we would, you know, put on long sleeve shirt, and
oh,
I mean, it was
gosh.
Like building
uh-huh.
building tunnels. We
yeah.
weren't just pushing ourselves through; we were
right.
constructing them. And so,
wow,
it.
What
but
fun.
I often think, you know, what was the chance of you know pushing a head into a, one of these tumbleweeds and then having a den of rattlesnakes in there? You
exactly.
know? But no damage ever happened. So
huh.
you know, we survived.
So during that period, you know, your first 10 years here as it's coming out to get 1964, did you guys do traveling? Did you do the kids in the car station wagon thing and we're going to go drive to the national parks?
Oh, yeah, we did that. We didn't do it so much then, at least maybe I don't recall it, but I do remember because they just put in the Black Canyon Highway,
okay.
right? And which now is I-17.
17,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had just put that in. It was, of course, much smaller than it is now, but it was a divided highway. And so I remember taking trips to Prescott for one, and this was in, as you said, in the station wagon. We had an Impala, Chevy Impala station wagon, and we also went to the Grand Canyon one time, and you know, that was probably for an overnight.
Okay.
We had the travel bug then. We didn't. I don't recall too many trips at that point, but we did a lot of traveling later on, and but I do remember those early trips, and in fact that trip to Prescott, I can remember very distinctly because, as I said, it was the first. You know, it was early on in the opening of the Black Canyon, and they had just built that Sunset Point.
Oh, wow.
Rest area. And I remember at the end of the day, we were coming back from this trip to Prescott and, you know, driving up to the rest area and this just tremendous sunset behind the the Bradshaw Mountains, right?
Yeah.
Across the I guess that's the New River Valley there. And, yeah, just a tremendous, beautiful Arizona sunset, you know, and you don't
nice.
Get those back east.
No. Know?
Because you don't have the expansive views, but
what do you remember of your first visit to Grand Canyon?
Well, I don't remember too much about it except one distinct thing, and you know, there's a lot of to a young boy. There's a lot of mystique in the Grand Canyon, and one of the things that really affected me or caught my imagination was the story about this hermit. I didn't know at the time it was Louis Boucher, but you know, the hermit who lived out at the in the canyon, and there was the place called the Hermit's Rest, you know. And I thought, what is this all about? And you know, I'm just reading like the brochures that you get when you enter the park.
Uh-huh.
You know, you used to get like quite a little booklet, right, when you entered a park, and
right.
telling you about the history and the natural history and the cultural history. And anyways, we did the standard tourist things, and we went out to Hermit's Rest at one point, and this was at the end of the day. I remember this again. And we're looking over the railing, and you can look, of course, right down into Hermit Canyon, right? And you can see across to the west side, and you've got the top of the red wall in there, or actually it's the Supai, and there's the trail there. Of course, you couldn't see the trail, right, because the Hermit's Trail, I'm sorry, the Boucher Trail at that time was just a trace. I'm sure. I didn't do it for another 10 years, but I just remember looking down there and my dad saying, yeah, that's where the Hermit lived, you know, pointing down there.
Down there to somewhere.
Yeah, down there to somewhere, and I just had this image in my head of, you know, this guy with his mule and making his trips around the canyon, and it was pretty invigorating. You know, it created a very distinct mental image, true or false, that was compelling to me as a kid. You know, and I remember saying to my dad, "Can't we go down there? Why can't we go down there?" And he said, "Oh, well, it's too far." You know, and my parents weren't really hikers, so they that would have been too big a deal for them to undertake to go.
Yeah.
Down the Hermit Trail any distance, right? They wouldn't have really been interested in that, but I could see it was a great place to go, you know, and even at that age, so I was like probably seven or eight, I guess, I just knew I was going to come back.
Wow.
You know?
Cool.
So, yeah. Huh. Yeah, it was really something.
So 1963 then, IBM must have been, I've been moved again.
Yeah. So then we moved to Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh, wow.
Back east, all the way across back east, and so I had starting to have, you know, when I get to that age, I start to have more recollections of daily life, and so my dad's position there was associated with the Space Flight Center, which used to George C. Marshall Space Flight Center, which was located there. I don't know what it's been renamed to now, but this is where they were testing the boosters for the Apollo moon mission.
Okay.
And so my dad was involved with setting up the computer systems for that work. And it was a really neat place because I was very fortunate to grow up middle class, right? And so I'd live in these neighborhoods with other IBM engineers and families and other professional people. And so we had a nice house in Huntsville, and up Huntsville, northern Alabama is kind of hilly country and slight, almost mountainous. Anyways, every week or so, there'd be all this rumbling, that would start the house shaking, and you could go out into our front yard and look down the hill and off into the distance. It's probably like 8-10 miles away was where they were testing these boosters, right, for the Apollo launches. And there'd be all this smoke billowing up. You couldn't really see the booster or anything, but you knew what it was, right? Because everybody knew what was going on there. Kind of like my wife later on. She, in her childhood, she grew up in Las Vegas, and she said they used to have the rumbling of the atomic bomb test.
Absolutely,
right?
That's right. Yep. Yeah.
But anyways, in Huntsville, we just had the moonshot boosters And one of the better things I remember about living in Huntsville, of course, great experiences for a kid, but I got to, you know, go to the Space Flight Center, and I actually met Wernher von Braun.
Oh, wow.
Through my dad. I'm sure I shook hands with him. I was only like eight or something,
mm-hmm.
or nine.
Uh-huh.
But I just remembered this experience. And even at that time, I knew who he was, right? He was the rocket man from Germany.
Yeah. Helping,
you know, the United States to build the rockets to take the guys to the moon. And so it was pretty neat, you know, and going with my dad to, the computer rooms, which were, perhaps you had a exposure to those when you were young, these really giant refrigerator rooms with these mainframe computers and tape spinning on them. It's like you see in 1960s vintage movies, right?
Yeah,
very primitive computers by today's standards, but it was pretty high tech at the time. You
right,
know?
Right.
Yeah.
And the great
yeah.
exponential climb of storage was beginning with 2 megabytes, and you know,
yeah.
off they went.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
That's right.
So now you're back in the humidity and back in the land of trees again, different climate again. Did you or your sisters, you know, oftentimes in school you can make friends and then you have to say goodbye and you go to a new place, you have to make new friends. Was that a problem with you guys, or was that pretty easy?
Well, for me, it was easy, and I don't know, you know, I just had no problems with making new friends, and quite honestly, I didn't have problems with leaving them behind. I mean, I'm sure I had sadness, right? But it was not a traumatic experience for me.
Okay.
My sisters, in contrast, were different because I remember them because we lived in Alabama for 3 years to 66 before we moved to Dallas, and I remember them being very upset when we had to leave to go to Dallas because they were leaving all their friends and social contacts and whatnot, even as little girls, right? I mean, they're still they're not big, but they were very taken by that, and upsetting. And I found out afterwards that my mother was disappointed too because she worked hard to get our houses nice, you know, she was also starting on her education degree. She wanted to be a teacher, so she was taking the training in Alabama to do that. And I think she actually had gotten a position at a school. And of course, when we moved to our next community, which was Texas, then she lost the seniority she had, and she had to get accredited all over again in Texas.
Right.
So, it was a little difficult for her, you know, in that sense, the challenges, and but you know, we all kind of grinned and bared it because that's what you did back then. But in my own case, I have to say it was always kind of excitement about going to the new place, you know. It wasn't this sense of dread or foreboding, you know, and overwhelming sadness about leaving friends behind. So
did you do the same thing in Alabama that you did in Phoenix, which was, let's get in the car and let's drive around and let's go see the sights here?
Yeah, we did that. And it was, one of the things we did every summer was we would drive all the way up to New York and visit the families there, right? Both sides, my grandmother in Albany area. And then my other grandparents, my mom's parents they lived on Long Island, a place called Center Reach. And, excuse me. So we would do that drive, and it got to the point, Tom, where I knew the entire road from Alabama to New York. I knew exactly where to turn everywhere.
Wow!
Right, because I kept detailed maps. I would cut you would go to Texaco gas station, and they would give you a map, right? If you asked for one, you get a state map, and I would cut that up and use a little colored pencil to show the roads we were driving, you know, and I put these books together showing the entire route of our trip, right? And I would keep all the receipts, you know, for the hotels and the gas and the food. And my parents thought it was kind of cute, I think, at the time, but I could see where it was kind of setting me up for a life of anal retention, I think, or something like that.
But I'm also going to ask because you were getting training in orientation to where you were, sense of place, meaning we're on this road, we're going this direction, we're going to come to this junction, we're going to turn that way. And so this is going to, I can see that this may help you in route finding in later years.
I never thought of it that way, but, you know, it certainly makes total sense. And I was so into it, you know, when these big trips came along to put these logbooks together, you know, and it was just really, you know, you cut out picture postcards of where you visited, right, and put them in there too, right?
Nice.
And yeah, it was real nice. And so we started, you know, at that time we were kind of traveling around. We went to see, some Civil War battlefields like, you know, Shiloh and Chattanooga. And I remember one place we went to with friends in the neighborhood, we went camping, place called Fall Creek Falls, which is in Tennessee, and it's just a small park. I've never been back since, but I think we went there a couple times with these big waterfalls. At that point, I started hiking, right? I was like, I don't know, 10 or 11, 12, something like that, 10 or 11, and we started hiking, and I would take my sisters on short little hikes out of the campgrounds, right? And
cool.
And my parents, you know, didn't have any problems with this. They were very, very supportive of us taking these adventures. But I remember one time we did this hike, and it was a this countryside is kind of, I think it's built on established on a sandstone unit, and the sandstone is what the waterfalls are in, right? So
okay.
You have the sandstone unit is flat lying, and where the creeks and streams have eroded back, you know, they have these canyons, and then they'd be headed by a sandstone waterfall, and the water would go plunging over the waterfall, and so, you know, you walk these horizontal trails on the tops of these sandstones, and then you get to where one of these waterfalls was, and so I remember just taking my sisters out, and we would just walk the sandstone slabs above the waterfall, and you know, not right at the edge or anything like that, but you know, within proximity, 20
mm-hmm.
feet or something like that. They didn't
right.
have railings keeping everybody herded in and
right.
away from places, so you could kind of go where you want. Well, I didn't know this at the time, but my mother and father are on the other side of the valley at a viewpoint, and they're looking across, and they can see us, the three of us, and from their perspective, it looks like we're, like, tiptoeing along the edge of this drop, right? And apparently it kind of freaked my mother out quite badly, because mm-hmm. she thought we were, like, in imminent danger.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the reality is totally wrong. We were, you know, quite a ways back.
Yeah, but she's a mom, you know. She went through childbirth to make sure you succeed, not fail. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. No, and I appreciated that afterwards. You know, I mean, we kind of got scolded when we returned, and particularly me, because I was the oldest one, and I was supposed to be in charge. And I understood, you know, where it was coming from, but I tried to explain that, you know, Mom, no, we were really, actually, we were quite farther back from the cliff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, we both had to accept that the other was right at a certain
uh-huh.
level,
uh-huh.
and, you know,
it was a
good lesson in acceptance and mutual respect, you know, for the other position. So
caution, yeah.
You know, I mean, I figured if being super cautious with my activities in the wilderness, I use that word loosely in this part of the world, in
mm-hmm.
Tennessee, right?
Right.
If that's the price of having the acceptance by my mother to let me do these things, then, you know, that's an easy price to pay, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Were
so.
You in Scouts at all?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I was actually, I joined the Cub Scouts when I lived in Alabama. And then I was in the Boy Scouts in Texas, and of course, you know, you don't like transfer immediately when you move to a new town, you to a new scout troop. I mean, I suppose you could do that, but it was kind of an organic thing. Like, you get your friends first, and then you found out which of your friends were scouts, and then you'd go to their scout troop meeting. Right.
Right.
So there were breaks in that program, but yeah, I picked it up again in Texas when we moved there. But certainly, I got started in the Cub Scout program in Alabama there. So
did you end up becoming an Eagle Scout?
No, it's one of the regrets of my life. You know, I only made it to life. So, you know, I figure I've kind of made up for it since then. So.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't hold it against myself too hard, you know.
And where did you learn to swim?
Well, it would have been there. Ew. Wow, that's a good question. When we lived in New York, as a small kid,
okay.
we would go, as I mentioned, up to northern New York State, because I would, in the summers, we would go up to visit my grandparents, and we would stay there for like 2 months, right,
oh, wow.
while my dad worked back in Alabama, and we would visit both sides of the family, and when we would go to my father's side of the family in northern New York, we would always go to what they call the lakes. We're going to the lakes, you know, and so there's a lot of lakes around there, and I remember, Caroga Lake was one lake, and Onondaga, I think. And anyways, you could go swimming in these lakes, and so there was plenty of opportunity for that, you know,
okay.
for learning to swim in the lakes. So I actually learned to swim in lakes rather than pools, you know.
Okay.
So when I was a kid in Phoenix, before we moved back east, it was – kind of uncommon for people to have pools then, you know. It just wasn't that common.
Mm-hmm.
It was still for people who were above our social economic group, I think,
yeah.
and became much more common in the later 60s and 70s. And of course, we would go to municipal pools and things like that. I remember going to pools like that in Phoenix.
Okay.
Swimming really, I think, took off in the East for me, you know, swimming in lakes.
Okay.
And which is nicer anyways because you're outdoors, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, within a pool, you always have, when you're in the pool, you always have the limit, the horizon of the edge of the pool, right?
Right.
Whereas in a lake, it's like you're out there and you can see sometimes miles, right, to in the distance. And,
right.
So.
Did you canoe? Did you guys boat?
Oh, yeah. We would do that a lot, and I got stories about canoeing later, I guess.
Okay.
And but we did canoe there, and I remember canoeing with my dad, you know, and partly that was through the scouts. You know, he would participate in the scout scouting adventures. You know, we would have these campouts and things like that.
Yep.
And, on a weekend, and a couple of dads would go with the cubs and take us out camping and, you know, doing things like this, like canoeing and hiking and whatnot. And I loved canoeing. It was a really great experience. I didn't do any overnight canoeing until later on. And,
okay.
But it was still nice to be out on the water.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, a canoe is very organic, and for me, it really made a connection with, you know, North American Aboriginal cultures,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, you could kind of imagine you were, you know, one of our Indian forefathers or brethren, out canoeing on these lakes, you know, 200 years previously, right? It was just kind
yeah.
of, it was just a connection with the landscape and with, older cultures, right? That,
yeah.
that for me was pretty, you know, pretty stimulating. So.
Nice. So then to Texas, 66?
That's right, yeah. 66, we moved to Texas, and there was some real trepidation on the part of my parents because we moved to Dallas. And, of course, you know, this was 3 years after Kennedy had been assassinated in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And as well, when we even when we were living in Alabama, we you know, it was the time of race riots and freedom marches and stuff like that, and you know, we didn't experience any of that directly, but we saw it on the news, and so moving to Texas was a little bit of concern because you know, we didn't know what to expect,
okay.
and my parents were nervous, and I mean, as it turned out, there was nothing to really be worried about as far as a kid growing up, because we always lived in safe neighborhoods, you know, there was really no serious issues to be dealt with as a kid. Now, the parents may have been hiding, you know, some of that from us. So, so we moved there to Dallas, and again, we got a beautiful house, you know, in a middle class neighborhood. And not quite on the outskirts of town like it had been in Alabama and in Phoenix, but you know, still a nice area. You know, I went to junior high there and high school, the first year of high school. So that would have been my sophomore year. So you have in Texas at that time you had junior high, which would have been, I think.
Freshman, sophomore, and then junior,
seventh,
senior.
Eighth, and ninth grades.
Okay.
Right? And then you'd go to high school, so you'd go for 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Right.
So your freshman year would be in junior high school, and as well as the 2 years prior to that. So anyways, you know, I went to this school, and it was a huge school. I mean, it is like, you know, four stories and
wow.
huge athletic fields and, you know, a big football team, and that was kind of like the introduction to Friday Night America for me, you know, with the football games and really big, strong football culture there. And
did you participate in sports?
No, I didn't participate in those sports. I got into track,
okay.
you know, cross country running, I didn't participate in the team sports. I just was kind of a skinny kid, you know.
Hmm.
And so not really built for those things. And I had a lot of other interests, too. So,
like what? What were you interested in school at that time?
Well, I like to read a lot, you know.
Okay.
And I like to I like to build, these model ships, and at the time too, that was really a big thing for me. So,
like sailing ships or more contemporary.
Well, I did both.
Okay.
I like the modern warships and things like that. Battleships and aircraft carriers, and I would get the biggest ones I could find. Right, that would take months to put together and paint and everything. But my favorite ones were the old sailing ships, and you could rig them with sails and all the rigging on them, and it would be with little threads and whatnot. It was a lot of fun to put those together.
And it took a long time. Yeah,
it did. It took a long time to paint and everything. And you can imagine, days and days and days in the winter. When the weather's not so great and you're kind of stuck at home, like we are now.
Right.
working on these details, and of course I built these models in my bedroom, and we had all this Testor glue and these paints, and a very poorly, I won't say poorly, but not well-ventilated bedroom. And I think part of the appeal of making these models was all this glue scent, that was floating around in my bedroom. Now, I didn't actually sniff these things, but I certainly did have exposure to them, and I'm sure that probably had some effect on me, mentally.
The appealing. Boy, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I feel great.
Get me another model,
Yeah.
So, but Texas was nice because it was different from Alabama. Alabama was very treed and was deciduous, and Texas, northern Texas, was a little bit more open, flatter and more open with rangeland and big lakes, and they had lakes that were, they're reservoirs, right? So, but people would go boating on the lakes, and we had friends that had power boats, and we'd go water skiing, but we had great opportunities there for hiking in the scout troop, and because it turns out in Texas, I think, if you know people with private land, that's your in. Most of the land there is all private.
Okay.
In contrast to the West, where it's mostly public lands,
yeah.
Right, with BLM and national forests and whatnot. In Texas, it was all private, and so if you were going to go hunting, if you were going to go camping or anything like that, and you wanted to get away from the crowds, you had to know somebody who would give you permission to go on their land, And my dad and his contacts knew some of these people, and anyways, they connected with landowners who let us go onto their land and go on these camping trips with the scouts primarily, and those were great trips. I mean, I just learned so much about outdoors camping there, and you do survival trips in the middle of winter when it's 25 degrees Fahrenheit, and at night, and you don't even have a sleeping bag. You gotta prepare yourself a shelter to keep yourself warm and all that. So it was really really educational but entertaining too, and lots of fun. So and it was great. My father did participate in those trips, right? And I remember at one point. So this would have been around 65, I guess, and I'm sorry, 67 or 68. He went on one of the trips with the scoutmaster, and I think there was one other father there. And the scoutmaster was this really amazing fellow, Jack Ballou, his name was, and they had a big wall tent, right? So this is where the dads hung out, in the wall tent. And the kids, the boys were just down in the creek bottom with our tents and camp set up and whatnot, doing our thing. And we mostly just hung out during the day, right, playing games and exploring. And we'd have, things to do like knot tying and building, stands or structures with timber and stuff like that. And the parents, the dads, hung out in the tent, right? And at one point, I remember going up there and chatting with them, and there's a big bottle of whiskey on the table there in front of the tent. So, the dads were having a great time out there along with the kids.
How do you spell Jack's last name?
B-A-L-L-O-U, Balou.
Thank you.
That's my recollection of it anyways.
Okay, good enough.
Yeah, I've tried to find him on the internet, and I'm sure he'd be passed away by now, but I have looked around to see if I could find any information on him, and I haven't been able to, so.
Okay.
Huh. But,
At this point, as early on into high school, were you thinking, you know, I'm kind of interested in this and that, and I want to study this a little more?
Yeah, definitely. In Texas, I started focusing on academics and career, you know, because there's in 1960s USA, there was kind of some pressure, you know, on you, especially if you were middle class like I was. Pressure on you to kind of select a career track, you know, and it's not like, you know, I don't think it was like sometimes the demands of Asian cultures on their kids, but there was consistent reminders to you that you needed to think about going to college and coming up with a career, and so I thought about that, and I actually got interested in architecture. And I remember I wanted to take this architectural drawing class that they offered in my high school, and I went down and I asked the counselor, you know, I said, I'd like to take this class, and they said, well, you can't, because you've got to take these classes, and you can't take more than six classes, and I said, well, why not, and they said, well, that's the rules, and so I was really bummed out, so I went home and told my dad this, and he said, this is stupid, he said, so he called up the school, and he said, look, why can't my kid take it, you know, if he flunks out, then okay, it was a mistake, but he could do fine in that class.
Right.
And so he argued for me, and he actually got them to bend the rules so that I could take this architectural drawing class.
Cool.
Yeah, it was very cool, and they went out and bought me these, you know, a compass, a really nice set of drawing instruments. And I still have that.
Like the repeatograph, ink lettering ink. Set, all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, erasure shield and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and, you know, the compass and dividers, and I have all that still in my office at work. So, yeah, it was pretty neat. And of course, the thing I liked about it was the precision, right?
Yeah.
We would be drawing plans for buildings, or, you know, exploded drawings for a toaster or something like that, you
right.
know. And you know, you learned how to be precise and mathematical with presenting an image on paper.
And and how to see it in your head.
That, good point. Good point. Yeah, for sure.
I'm making a case here for navigational expertise. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, there's a very easy jump from there to topographic maps, you know, and I never had a problem, you know, figuring out what a topographic map meant or how it, you know, was conveying the landscape.
Right.
And so that was very, very formative for me. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to tell you one thing about the canoeing, though.
Yes, please.
Because in Texas, let's see here. How did my dad know Carthauser? Anyways, my dad worked with a fellow named Carthauser, Dave Carthauser, and he was still alive a couple of years ago. So my dad worked, again, at IBM office in Dallas, and he would do work in Fort Worth quite a bit, which is a smaller city to the west of Dallas. And his colleague there was a guy named Dave Carthauser, and Dave ran a scouting troop there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by this time I was already in the scouts in Dallas, but it was something for my dad and his partner to talk about, right? Their son's various scouting adventures and the things they did too in support of their son's scout troops. And so I didn't actually meet him for some time, but my dad, through his discussions at work, you know, found out that Carthauser was the scoutmaster, and he was taking his boys on a trip up to what's called the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in northern Minnesota.
Whoa.
And so this was a scout, Boy Scouts of America base for canoe trips.
Wow.
And so scout troops would come from all over the U.S. and some from Canada, I think, and converge on Ely, Minnesota, where the Wilson, Charles C. Wilson, no, Charles Summers, canoe base was located. And And then you would take these 10-day trips up across the international border into what's called the Ketiko Boundary Waters wilderness area. And so it's just thousands and thousands of lakes, right, that are all linked by canoe routes and portage trails. And you know, you would go up with your crew, and you'd have a guide and who was like a high school kid, right, or a college kid.
Someone who knew the way, and that was that.
Exactly, and would teach you how to canoe and how to cook on a fire if you didn't know all these things, you know. But anyways, so my dad is talking to his friend Dave, and Dave says, you know, I'm leading this trip up to Minnesota. One of the boys had to drop out, you know. Would your son be interested? My dad said, you know, and this was on fairly short notice. I think it was like a week. And my dad said, well, I can certainly ask him. And so he came home, and I hadn't met the other boys or my dad's friend at that point. So he said, well, what do you think? You want to go on this trip? And, of course, you know, how could I say no, right?
Yeah.
So I said, sure, yeah, count me in. So anyways, I had to buy a bunch of stuff, right, you know, proper gear for canoeing, which wasn't much, you know. We didn't have the choice and selection of fancy outdoor gear that we have today. And so I put that together, and then I, you know, my parents took me to the bus stop on the Saturday morning where we were going to depart from Fort Worth and then head up to Minnesota. And so I met the other Boy Scouts and my dad's friend, Dave. You know, it's the first time I met him, and I remember he told my dad after we got back, he said, you know, when your son first showed up there, I was a little apprehensive because he was a slight fellow, you know, and I was pretty raw. I mean, I was pretty young, right? I think I was probably the youngest one on the trip. I think he was just a little nervous that I wasn't going to have the gumption to pull it off, right? You know. But it worked out fine. We had a great trip.
Cool.
Great trip. And I actually reconnected with this fellow, Dave, a couple of years ago. He lives in Texas still.
Oh, fun. Huh.
And the way I got in touch with him was because you get interested in these things you did when you were a kid, and you want to try and remember more about them. And so I started looking on the website, and of course the internet has been the boon for this because it allows you to explore these,
track
these
people down. Yeah,
exactly. And so I went to the website for the Charles Summer Wilderness Canoe Base, and I found that they had a list of all the trips, right? And they actually had our photo. They had a photo of our crew, you know, that they had taken,
cool.
And it was online, and I saw, you know, I saw. It was incredible, Tom, because I hadn't thought about the details of this trip for decades, right? And this was about 60, I think it was 68, and could have been 67. I had to go back to my notes. But I hadn't thought about this for decades, and as soon as I saw that photo, it's like I remember all these kids, all these boys,
wow.
You know, all their personalities. I remembered a few of their names. Most of them I didn't remember their names, but I remembered them. As fellow explorers, adventurers, you know, and the good times we had, and it was so cool, you know. And so, I actually wrote to the base camp, and I said, look, you know, I can give you some information about this trip. You know, the leader was this guy, and so then I actually spent more time tracking down through the local Texas scouting agencies there. I tracked down this fellow Dave Carthauser, who had been the leader of this trip, right? And I called him and about 3 or 4 years ago, and we had a really good talk about all this. And he sent me photos that that he had taken. You know, I mean, nothing great, but not like you get today, but still some sort of a record, right?
Exactly.
And I took those. I took the slides in. I took them in and spent a lot of money to get them. Scanned, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I sent him the slides back with the digital images, and of course
nice.
They cleaned them all up, and they photoshopped them so that, you know, the dark areas came out. I mean, it's great, right? And he was able to fill in the names of, like, you know, most of the other boys, and so we've got a pretty good record of that trip now, and
cool.
And where we went and whatnot. And of course I had a map, right? I had a map that I'd obtained on the trip, and I had penciled in the entire route that we had canoed, right? So I already had that, and he was interested to see that, and so it was a great way to connect. And I remember telling him that, I was 68, and I said, 2018 is going to be the 50th anniversary.
Oh wow!
And we should get all the guys together, but nothing ever happened. So.
Oh.
This guy's in his 90s now. So
yeah, and that's
he may have passed on since then.
That's CARDHOUSER.
It's KART, Cart, HAUSER.
Thank you.
Karthauser.
All right.
So
nice.
I told him when I spoke with him on the phone. I said, it's great to talk to somebody who was on this trip, but I want you to know, particularly as you're the leader of it, how influential it was for me as a boy growing up. It was just such a wonderful introduction to the wilderness and being out, because this was like the first big trip I ever took, away from home and into the wilds. It was 10 days. It was all very controlled and coordinated by the scouts. I mean, they don't want to have any problems.
Right.
But for somebody who comes from an urban environment and has only done, minimal exposure and hiking and stuff like that, it was a big step. And it was, and I wanted him to know that, right? That it had basically informed a lot of my life subsequent to that.
Nice.
So.
Yeah, yeah. For portages, you have to carry all your gear from shore to shore across some distance, and then you have to carry the boat that same distance as well. It's a lot of work.
It is, for sure. Sometimes you do multiple trips back and forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I remember they have these what do they call those packs? Voyageur packs. And it's just a giant canvas bag, with a couple of rough canvas straps sewed onto it that you put your shoulders in, and another canvas line that goes around your forehead called a tump line.
Mm-hmm.
And you would just you would pack all your stuff into these packs to put them in the canoe, right? And that's where you transport them. They're roughly waterproof, not very good, but roughly waterproof.
Yeah.
And so then when you get to the portage, you come ashore, you unload the packs, pull the canoe out of the water, and then you put one pack on. So, typically the guy who was going to carry the canoe would get a light pack. And then you'd, hoist the canoe up on your shoulders, and then somebody, you'd carry it, right? You'd balance it up there, and you could carry it to the next water body. And I remember, I think the longest portage we did was about a mile.
Wow.
And so it was, fairly significant, a big effort to get all the gear across. But again, it's just like one of these links with the opening of the continent, right? Because this is how they got around. The explorers, the voyageurs, got around mapping the continent, 200 years ago, was often by the waterways, and this is how they did it, and I just really that really impacted me, So that's one of the reasons I think I love canoeing so much.
Nice.
Is the connection with the land. Even though you're on water, it's the connection with the broader landscape.
But it's muscle powered. You're connected to the paddle, connected to the water, connected to the boat. It's a very interesting journey.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Nice.
Yeah, those were good times. And we would also, living in Texas, that's when we started our big family camping trips. Because my dad would get, through IBM, he would get like a month of vacation that he could take all at once in the summer.
Wow.
And we would pack up the station wagon with, we had a big Coleman canvas tent, and with aluminum poles and cots and bedrolls and camp stoves, and all this would go in the car, and then the three kids would find little cramped cubby holes inside all that to lay in, and then we would drive from there up to the Canadian Rockies.
Wow.
Or to Yellowstone or Glacier Park, places like that, the classic national parks.
Yep.
And then one year we spent in southwestern Colorado. That was a lot of fun too, going to Durango and Compaugre Forest and Silverton. And you know, and I at that point I remember one day my dad and I did a 6 mile hike to get to a creek to fish in, right? And it was such a big deal to go on this 12 mile round trip hike with my dad and go fishing and bring the fish back, you know, and then we ate them with my mother. And so I have no idea where that hike was. I'd like to, you know, it'd be nice to remember where it was, but we had a lot of opportunities like that, you know. And at that point, you know, my parents were they were letting me go on solo hikes quite readily. And in fact, when we were in Texas, we went on one of these long vacations up to Glacier National Park. And I said, before we went on this, I said, "Well, I'm going to get my hiking merit badge, you know, while we're on this trip. I'm going to do the hike to get the merit badge." And so we went to Glacier Park, and I said, "I'm going to take this hike." I plotted it out on the map, you know, that this wasn't a topographic map. This was a map of the park that was in the brochure that the Park Service gave you, right? But it showed the trails, right? And I said, "I can do this trip." And it was like 14 mile circuit, right? And they said, "Fine, go ahead. No, you know, solo hiking, right? No big deal." They let me go, and so I took a couple of pictures. And I remember there was forest fires going on, so it was kind of had to go over a pass, right, called Saya Pass. And I got to the top of the pass, and it was all kind of hazy from smoke, right? So I didn't get tremendous distant views, but still neat experience. And being out in all these Precambrian rocks too, that was really neat as well. So. But I get back, you know, to Dallas, and I write all this up, and I go to see the merit badge counselor, and I'm showing him these hikes, right? I'm talking about the hikes that I'm doing, and he didn't believe me.
No
He didn't
way.
believe he didn't believe well, he didn't question me directly, right? But he went to my dad to confirm that I'd actually done these hikes, you know, because I think he thought in a way that my parents were being irresponsible by letting me go out and do these things.
Maybe he was thinking there's another merit badge in here you should get, which is, you know, solo navigation or something like that.
Yeah, maybe so, yeah. I mean, we should have created that badge then, right? No, but it was like, you know, it was so, I thinking back on it all, I you know, I really appreciate the freedom that my parents gave me with respect to these hikes. And in particular, once we finally got back into Arizona the second time, I started doing really, you know, much more serious things. And there was always the support there, right? I know that it was difficult, you know. I know that when I went away on these longer hikes, you know, I did a 30-day trip in the canyon once, and right out of high school, and my mother was very apprehensive. I learned this from my father afterwards, and but she kept it hidden, right? And so all these times when I'm going to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area or Philmont Scout Ranch or wherever, you know, she was totally supportive and let me do what I told them I would do. And I guess, you know, at the time I didn't appreciate it. I didn't understand it, but you know, she, I think, accepted that I had good judgment on these things. And I think my dad did tell me. He said, "This is what I tell your mother every time." He said, "Don't worry, you know, the kid has good judgment. He's not going to get himself into trouble." And which was true, you know. And I kind of figured that I've never had a, you know, major incident in the wilds happen to me. I think partly that's because, you know, the being very judicious, right, and not pushing things and backing off when you have to, right?
Well, and you've got to learn too, and they understand that. It's interesting to look at what your parents' generation was able to do as children, which was more than what you were able to do as a child. So, you know, parents are trying to protect their kids. It's a really fascinating sort of vision of what a 12-year-old can do, what a 14-year-old can do. You know, back in Billy Hawkinson on the Powell trip in 1869 was 18 years old.
Yeah, incredible, huh?
So yeah, you know, look at these things and go, okay.
Yeah.
So where do you move from Houston? Sorry, from Dallas.
Well, from after Dallas in 70, excuse me, then we moved back to Scottsdale, back to Arizona. And so at that point, quite honestly, my dad quit. He quit IBM because he was in Dallas, and they said to him, okay, the next spot is Flint, Michigan.
Ooh.
Yeah. And he said, you know what? I'm paraphrasing. I wasn't there, of course, at the time. But he said, I've had it with this moving business. I'm not going to Flint, Michigan. And he talked to her with my mom, and I think they both agreed that Phoenix, you know, when they lived there in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
was where they wanted to go. And so my dad quit, and he got a job with Arizona Public Service.
Oh, okay.
Is that what it's called, Arizona?
Yeah.
That's the power
APS,
company.
You bet.
APS, yeah. And, you know, heading up their computer operation there. So we moved out in 70 from Texas. And, but, you know, by that time I was driving a car. I got to drive the car, whichever car it was that we had at that time, Plymouth, I think. I got to drive that part of the way out from Texas to Phoenix. And, you know, it was another grand adventure moving across the country. You know, I have to say it was just like one of those opportunities that I always look forward to every 3 or 4 years, right?
Yeah, you know, Jim, let's put a comma here
and
wrap up part one, and we'll pick up part two with the move to Phoenix.
Okay.
All
right. Sure, that sounds great.
Do you have anything else you want to add about the ground that you've covered before we wrap this up?
Well, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it because we could digress into another big discussion. But I have to say, you know, particularly here after reflecting on what we've talked about, you know, one of the things that's come out in our discussion here is the tremendous variety of geography that I was exposed to as a kid.
Yeah.
And that combined with the Boy Scouts and the supportive adults who I lived with and interacted with, you know, really framed, you know, my interest in the outdoor world, right? And not only from just a recreation point of view, but also from a geological point of view and natural history point of view. And, you know, thinking back, as we talked about earlier, those waterfalls in Texas, you know, I can still remember the sandstone beds, right, and the structure there of the local geology that created those waterfalls, and it just all comes together. That's the point I wanted to make. You know, so many of these life experiences that you have end up, you know, creating the person you are.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Cool. All right, then. With that, we'll conclude part one of Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, November 29th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thanks a lot, Tom, yourself, and I look forward to chatting next time.
All right, hang on.